Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up Podcast. I'm Chris Solomon, absolutely thrilled to have on the show today Jim Mackay, of course, better known as Bones. Bones, thank you so much for your time, for joining us. Thank you to the folks at Callaway to help make this happen. I know you just had double knee replacement surgery. How are the knees treating you right now?
Chris, thanks. They're doing pretty well. Saw the doc today, and he's happy with where we're headed, and he actually gave me the go-ahead today to start maybe even playing golf, which is huge for me because, as we all know, this is caddy golf season right now.
How many times a week do you play golf during the off season?
If I'm healthy, my wife's nice enough to let me go out two or three times, and I love it. I've got a couple of caddy buddies here in town that play where I do, and we just go out and we have a ball. And actually saw Colt Nose yesterday out at the golf course, so I'm looking forward to getting out and maybe playing some golf with him too. So I love to do it.
So what does a typical week look like for you where you're not out on tour? And I know this time of year is probably a longer stretch of time where you get to stay at home or get to spend some time with your family. But what is a typical week look like when you're not toting the bag?
You know, a lot of traveling, taking kids to and from school, things like that. I live in Arizona, so this time of year especially, the weather is really good, you know, so very grateful for, you know, that time when I come home and the weather is kind of in the 70s and 60s, if you will, so that's nice. I spend time obviously with my wife and my kids and have fun and try and stay in as good a shape as I can and just kind of decompress, but, you know, I certainly don't lose sight of the fact that I'm very lucky to work for a guy like Phil who certainly doesn't play, you know, doesn't have to play a ton of tournaments at this point in his career or ever because he's done so well. And so I'm not probably as affected by the whole kind of grueling, you know, amount of the season as some guys are.
Do you and Phil had to have planned to have surgery at the same time, right?
I swear to you, we didn't. It was just a deal where I knew he had his thing going on and he certainly knew about mine. And as we got late in the year, I think it was we were in Napa. It was either at the Ryder Cup or Napa. And I said, by the way, what day are you having surgery? And he said, October 19th. And I swear to you, we were on the operating table at the same time. So it was just bizarre.
I mean, you obviously plan this for your longest time off, though. I mean, are you at any risk of not making it back out there for when Phil tees it up next?
I hope not. I mean, I'd be nuts to say, you know, that there is zero risk. But I'm in really good shape. I really did my homework, I feel, with the doctor, and it went well. And I'm really lucky because if we do indeed start at Palm Springs the first week of the year, it couldn't be a better place to start for me because the courses are small, flat. The weather's typically pretty good. And playing with amateurs, the pace of play will be pretty slow. And that'll be that'll give me an opportunity to keep up.
So what is, and I'm not sure how long you've been dealing with knee problems, but I'm curious as to what courses stick out to you as, I imagine somebody that's battling knee problems, there's some courses where you're like, oh, this one's going to be a tough walk. But off the top of your head, what are some of the top courses you think of that Phil usually plays where you're like, man, this is going to be tough on my knees?
Yeah, you know, certainly you get a course like Augusta, and that's, you know, incredibly hilly in places. But then again, that week you have so much adrenaline going through you, it doesn't affect you as much as it otherwise would. The funny thing is, it can actually not be hills in as much as it can be grasses. Like you get on Zoysia, like you may have in Memphis, where you just, you know, your foot gives a little bit as you step, and you don't get the kind of leverage that you normally do, and that might catch up to you, you know, even more so than the hills will.
Have you ever missed a tournament with Phil, or have you caddied every single one since he became a professional?
Yeah, I think there's been two tournaments where he's taken other people. He took his buddy Rob Mangini to Japan one year, and his coach caddied for him in the 1992 Tucson Open. So, you know, other than those two events, I've pretty much caddied in everything. Other than there's been, I think, two rounds where I've had one year at Valderrama in Spain. I had food poisoning just like you can't imagine and had no shot for a couple of days, and he grabbed a local, but I haven't missed too much work.
It's funny you mentioned Rob Mangini because my uncle he was the best man at my uncle's wedding, and I played golf with Rob Mangini at that wedding, and I beat Rob on that day, and my uncle made me promise. He's like, if you ever get a chance to meet Phil, make sure you tell him that you beat Rob. And I did one day at the memorial, and Phil was signing for a bunch of people, and his head just perked up immediately. I said, well, I just got to let you know I beat Rob Mangini in golf. And Phil's like, well, that's not very hard.
Exactly. Yeah, it sounds like Phil. I'm glad you've had a chance today to mention that, too, because when I see Rob, I'm going to mention it myself.
He probably won't even remember. First, he'll deny it, and I doubt he remembers it, because it was 7 years ago or something like that. But I'm curious to hear what you think about how much has your job changed since cell phones have been allowed on golf courses?
Oh my gosh, what a question. You know, that's an amazing question. You just can't imagine. I mean, I hate the fact that, you kind of have to police that out there. As a caddy, you're out there and you're thinking about the wind and the yardage and what club, your guy's hitting. And then you start, before you even want to, you have to kind of turn away from what's going on with your player and look around, for cameras. And I get it, to a degree that the folks want pictures and all that stuff, but it's crazy. And if everybody came out there and put their phone on silent, it would be a breeze. And Phil's great about it. He'll tell people as he's walking in between shots, hey man, snap away. It's just, please don't do it when I'm actually, physically hitting the ball. But yeah, to answer your question, it's changed things dramatically. And, that being said, though, a lot of the tournaments, the Memorial would be a perfect example, have become incredibly proficient at helping the players out with this. And the people get their shots and the guys enjoy the golf.
It's funny you mentioned the Memorial, because I was actually there on the eighth tee box several years ago. I forget which year. I think it was 2012 when Phil, he'd had enough. He had enough of the cell phones, and you guys were talking over the shot, and he came back to the bag, and he said, I can't even focus right now. I think it was that 2012? And you may not remember the year he withdrew after one round.
It's a great, it's probably right on. I know we were playing with Bubba and Ricky, and I think maybe Bubba had just won the Masters. I'm not sure, but obviously, three of them of the most popular players in the game, and it just got, it got a little nutty that day. But as I said, I mean, I think I've said to the guy that the gentleman that runs that tournament, we've gone back the last year or two, they've done an amazing job of helping him out with that.
I think they put extra security on Phil's group now because of that. I do remember seeing like extra guys with the mobile device enforcements come sprinting up and warning people before Phil comes. That's what you get when you're as respected as Phil is. When Phil's practicing, let's say you're not a practice round in an official tournament, how often are you there? Do you guys meet up ever during the off season for practice rounds, or when he practices, is he totally on his own?
Yeah, he's on his own, I'd say 99% of the time. He does his thing. I like to give Phil as much space as I possibly can. He obviously sees so much of me during the year. And the great thing about Phil is he's doing it. I'm amazed at 46, that he wants it as bad as he did at 22. And I know he's working his butt off wherever he is and is really, really into it. And now we have this really great relationship with Andrew Getson, who's the guy that started teaching him, before last year's tournaments. And Andrew lives here in Arizona, and he can just whip over and see Phil at the drop of a hat, and it works out perfectly. So, if Phil ever wants me to do something with him, I'll do it. Certainly if he goes to majors to prepare or whatnot, I'll go with him if it works out. But Phil's a guy actually that likes his privacy, and he's actually a guy that when he's warming up before tournaments on the tour, he's not necessarily a guy that's going to put down his range balls next to a certain guy so it can be a social occasion. I mean, he's kind of all business and all work, and if anything, he likes to kind of have his privacy so he can get things done.
And do you caddy for him in like corporate events or outings or stuff like that, or is he pretty much on his own for those?
Yeah, I've certainly been to a bunch over the years. I mean, I would say, maybe a third of the time, but I'm so lucky that, because he represents these companies and they're great to me, be it KPMG, companies like that over the years, that I become friends with folks that run these companies and run these outings. So I enjoy going and seeing, John Vemeyer from KPMG, for example. He's just, wonderful people. And so they're fun, and you meet some interesting people over the years, one of the things I found being a caddy is these the relationships that you kind of forge over time, that you, people you come incredibly close to. It's not just, you know, caddies or players. It's, you know, businessmen or women that you meet at these outings or the like.
Well, if you do see John V. Meyer anytime soon, can you put a nice word for me for a raise for next year or something like that? So.
I'm going to text him as soon as we get off the phone.
Actually, don't tell him that I have a golf podcast outside of my normal job, so I don't want to draw any attention to that. So I find the dynamic just between your and Phil's relationship so interesting, just because I find Phil such an interesting guy and can't. I can just only imagine some of the things that he says during the round. So, how much does he talk during a round, and how much of it is just like crazy random theories about things that aren't even related to golf? I just want to know like what kind of things he talks to you about during a round when he's not talking about golf.
I mean, we talk about, you know, everything, you know, politics, sports, movies, you name it, dinner, you know, whatever it is, you know, he's. You know, you hit it on the head. Phil's he's a very kind of sociable guy, and he likes to talk. And you know, you get these pairings out there, and he'll talk to anybody about, you know, anything. And it's great, and I like it because it keeps him loose, and it's what makes him comfortable and whatnot. But yeah, he's the thing about Phil that I figured out really early on is that he's got something akin to a photographic memory, and you have to be really careful what you say to Phil, because. If you say something different than what you said originally, he'll say, wait a second, you know, 3 years, 4 months and 19 days ago, you said this. And so he'll call you on it. So he's, he likes to read and learn about things. So there's always something interesting to talk about.
What if you could think of one off the top of your head, what's the cockiest moment Phil's ever had between the ropes to you on a golf course?
Well, I mean, listen, he's like a lot of those guys out there, I think that have achieved a certain level of success. You know, he'll basically, you know, he'll, I'll tell you this. We were at, actually at the Ryder Cup this year on Sunday. You know, we get out there and, you know, obviously the U.S. had a pretty big lead, but, you know, big leads have been lost before on Sunday at the Ryder Cup. And I don't need to tell you how much this Ryder Cup meant to the U.S. and how it was basically a must win. And so, you know, you're out there as a caddy and you're trying to kind of, you know, read your player as you get off the first tee and see how he's doing, you know, how he's handling the day and whatnot. And so basically I was talking to him, you know, early in the round, just kind of, you know, you're taking your player's temperature in a sense. And he just looks at me, he goes, hey, man. Seriously, I got it. I don't need any coaching today. I don't need anything of you. I have flat out got it. And, you know, and that was the day he ultimately made 10 birdies and played as well as he did in the match against Sergio. So, you know, there's probably a couple other things I could tell you over a beer, maybe that weren't on a podcast, but that's all you're getting from me today.
I'll cut this short then, if that's the case, and we'll just do all the offline stories you can. You brought up the Ryder Cup in that particular match, and there's something I wanted to ask you about that. I think I've replayed that final putt that Phil made on the 18th green about 5 or 6 times, and I'd find myself not necessarily watching him after it and watching your reaction to it, because there was a big pause from you, and then you just let out a ferocious, angry at the ground fist pump, like just a true excitement. What? I mean, I know that you were just elated for Phil in that moment, but it felt like there was just like this build up and this. It felt like that meant something more to you than just like a normal celebration on the 18th green. So, is there anything to that? What was that feeling like for you?
Yeah, there's a lot to that, and I'll try and keep it short. But the bottom line is. You go to these Ryder Cups and you know, I've been fortunate enough to go to the last 10 or 11 of them, and they're amazing, amazing events. And, you know, we all want to win. The American golf public wants us to win, and we haven't been winning very much, you know. And, you know, certainly in the wake of the 2014 Ryder Cup, you know, ending the way it did in Scotland and ending the way it did at the press conference afterwards, you know, Phil put a lot on his own shoulders. And he kind of, you know, ran with the ball. And I'm so glad that he did, because a lot of things that desperately needed to be changed got changed and quickly. And so, you know, going into this year's Ryder Cup, in addition to the fact that we haven't been winning them, you know, I certainly felt the pressure that Phil had on him, if that makes sense. And so for you know, him to play the way he did, he played pretty darn well the first 2 days. And then just to go out there on Sunday and to play that well under pressure and just to be in a match when you're playing a guy who's literally hitting it 305 yards down the middle of every single fairway and then make that putt on 18, I was really happy for him. I was really happy for the team. I was really happy for all the people that have been, you know, come up to us and say, geez, can we just win a Ryder Cup, you know, and things along those lines. So there was a lot that went into that week and that moment.
Yeah, I found that very refreshing as a fan, just because I know that obviously caddying for Phil, somebody who's made the second most money of all time on the PGA Tour, I would imagine your monetary benefits of being a caddy are kind of they're settled at least, and I think there's a lot more art to your craft, if I may say, in that you're invested in his success more so than you know, just from a financial perspective, obviously. So I find that the caddy's excitement level about the Ryder Cup and interest in the Ryder Cup so fascinating. And I remember reading somewhere where you said before you even had caddied for Phil, it kind of weighed into your decision to move from, I think, Curtis Strange's bag to his bag, was you had a goal of caddying in the Ryder Cup and you saw Phil as your ticket into caddying for the Ryder Cup. Am I remembering that right, first of all?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. I was actually working for Scott Simpson at the time, but certainly working for Curtis a little bit too. On he had a rotation of guys at the time, but you're 100% right. My, you know, and listen, you know, as you know, the caddy turnover rate is incredible. So I'm thinking, well, if I go to work for Phil Mickelson here, I have this opportunity. But boy, I hope I can hang in there for a year or two because, you know, statistically, you're just not going to last that long. And they've always said that you never want to be a great player's first caddy because typically they're always going to make a change at some point, you know, and find somebody else out there they'd rather work with. But yeah, my thinking at the time was, my gosh, I don't know how long I'm going to caddy and keep my head above water out here. So my only goal as a caddy is to caddy in one Ryder Cup, and the entire decision, you know, to a large degree went into that.
Did it meet the hype once you finally got to do it? And now that you've done it 10 times, is it does it still give you the same kind of feeling?
Even more so. Wow. I mean, I don't know what it is. I mean, you know, it's just the most amazing experience. And I think, you know, Phil and probably other guys have said it in interviews that, you know, as you get to a certain point in your career, it's like these team events mean as much to you as anything, just because there's so much fun. There's so much kind of bonding. You have relationships with these guys you really wouldn't otherwise do for the most part. I mean, you see a side of folks that you aren't going to see, you know, in a good way, and it's just, it's incredible. And I mean, this year, you know, with the whole Tiger thing and Tiger just taking the leadership role that he did, and obviously what went on with Bubba, you know, and I know you know the whole Bubba Ted thing, that, you know, when it turned out that Bubba was going to be an assistant captain on the team and he was up there, and that was great. I admired him very much for doing it. But as caddies, we were like, well, where's Ted? You know what I mean? So, you know, they got Ted on the next plane up there, and they were a big part of it. So there was just a lot to this Ryder Cup.
How many more, if you were to place a bet on it now, and how many more Ryder Cups do you think Phil has in him?
Well, I tell you what, if you ask him about being a captain, he does not want to have that conversation right now. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Because he refuses to, you know, acknowledge that he's not going to be on, you know, the next team or the team after that. And I love it about him. And I hope it works out exactly the way he wants it to. So, you know, my gosh, you know, more than, you know, multiple is the answer to that, you know, be it, you know, Paris, Wisconsin, you know, Rome, whatever. And obviously there is that, you know, Ryder Cup, you know, lurking at Bethpage there in about 24. And he's got those ties to that community and to that golf course. And that would be super cool, you know. But right now, he is all about playing and doesn't even want to hear about it.
So my dream of him being a playing captain in 24 is still alive, is what you're telling me.
It's definitely alive.
Yes, yes. That's like my number one golf goal, I think, to see is Phil be a playing captain, send himself out first. I can't wait for it. But
send himself out first. That's hilarious.
So you just had mentioned when you got on Phil's bag, you weren't sure what the shelf life would be like or how long you'd be with him. Was there ever, and I think you probably got past a certain point where you stopped fearing this at any point, but was there ever a time where there was a moment of contention between you two where you felt like there's a possibility you may part ways, or has the relationship been as awesome as it appears on TV?
No, the relationship's been great. I mean, you know, like any other playing caddy, you know, we've had our moments, you know, but in a sense, that's part of being a caddy. You know, in my opinion, you know, the most important thing about being a caddy is not being afraid to disagree with your player, and certainly not being afraid to have a different opinion than he does at a big moment. And so, he's been great. I mean, you know, I didn't know Phil before really going to work for him. We'd met, you know, once or twice, but he didn't know me and I didn't know him. And you know, we went to see how this whole thing would go and unravel, and it's been great. You know, I'm very, very grateful for how he's treated me, how generous he is. And, you know, he's a good guy to be around. One of my favorite stories, I'll tell you a quick story if I can.
Oh, please. That's what you're here for.
Okay. When he won the Masters in 04, you know, for his first major win, you know, big monkey off his back, whatever the case may be, you know, as a caddy, you know, they take him away and he goes and does, he talks to the press and he goes to dinner with the members. And as a caddy, you don't see him for hours. I mean, I'm not off the clock yet, so I'm sitting there and I'm waiting until I can do what caddies ultimately do, which is to throw the clubs in the car, you know, say goodbye, great plan, and that's the end of your week. So there we are. He's won the Masters. You know, it's 6:30 on a Sunday evening, and I don't see this guy for like 3 or 4 hours. So I'm sitting in this parking lot or near it outside the Augusta National Clubhouse, and it must have been, 10 o'clock. And I look out to his car and I see some figures. It's pitch black dark out there and it's Phil and there's two or three other people around him. So I walk there to kind of help out with packing the bag. And as I walk up to him, I see these guys are hugging Phil and they're not just hugging him. They're like, it's like an emotional hug. And as I get closer, I realize that I have no clue who these other two or three guys are. And I'm like, man, who are these guys hugging Phil that I don't know. I've been his caddy for quite a while now and I've got no clue who these guys are. Well, it turns out, these are the guys that work in the lower locker room at Augusta National. Phil's been tipping all these years and taking such good care of. And now that Phil's won the Masters, he's going to the Champions locker room. And these guys are losing him forever. And they are just devastated.
Wow.
So they're hugging it out in the parking lot. I thought that's really cool. That kind of speaks for how he must have taken care of them over the years.
And knowing Phil, he probably drops in there still from year to year. And still probably says hello to those guys.
Absolutely.
One random event that I've always wanted to ask about is the 2014 PGA Championship. Yeah. Phil was runner-up, playing in the second-to-last group. Darkness was approaching after some rain delays that morning, and the tournament just ended really, really awkwardly with Rory basically playing up with you guys on the 18th hole. Afterwards, Phil was as reserved as I think he's capable of being, biting his tongue, yet kind of wanted everyone to know that he was not real pleased with what happened. Behind the scenes, was it a different scenario? I don't think what happened had an outcome on or effect on the outcome, but I can tell Phil wasn't too pleased with that. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I would say, you know, I don't want to speak for Ricky, you know, Phil's playing partner, but I don't think anybody was particularly happy. I mean, you know, listen, Rory is one of the great guys in the game, an absolutely phenomenal guy, and everybody loves him, us included. And there was no question that when we got to the tee, and we had waited an uncomfortable amount of time waiting to hit our tee shot there in the fourth round because it's a reachable par five, you could see this storm coming in. And it's a goofy tee shot. It's from a very elevated tee with a water hazard on the right and this bunker on the left. And, you know, we drove off the tee and then Rory and whoever he was playing with, I think it might have been that Wiesberger guy, came up on the tee behind us. And we kind of knew what was going to happen. And the two PGA of America club pro guys that were the rules officials in the groups, there was some kind of communication between them and basically, our guy says to Rory, to Ricky and Phil, can Rory play through? Can Rory hit up? And they said, absolutely. I mean, it was totally the gentlemanly thing to do. You knew that, you know, CBS, who I assume they wanted it done Sunday night. The last thing anybody wants to do is to come back Monday morning, the volunteers, TV, anybody. So we were doing it. It was a nice thing to do for Rory. It was a nice thing to do for everybody. But what happened that was completely, you know, out of line was that the rules official, or excuse, I shouldn't say the club pro walking with our group took it upon himself to tell Rory he could also hit up on the second shot. Hmm. And that's a completely different animal. I mean, at this point, we're trying to make eagle. I can't remember. Phil's maybe two shots back. I can't remember. You know, Rory hit a drive into a position where it was obvious he was most likely not going to make a four. And so it was handled really, really badly by the official that walked with our group. And I thought that Phil and Ricky did an amazing job of kind of biting their tongues, especially when after the fact the guy, I think, threw Ricky under the bus and said, yeah, it was Ricky's idea to tell Rory to hit up, and that wasn't the case at all.
Yeah, if anything, if I remember, I think Phil made birdie, and I think Ricky missed a rather short putt that, if I remember right, cost him like around $250,000 or something like that.
Absolutely. You're right. He 360'd a 5 or 6 footer that cost him a ton of money. And, you know, at that point, I can't remember if it was Ryder Cup points or what it was, because that was a Ryder Cup year, I think. And, you know, there's a lot going into that. And again, you know, for the guy to take it upon himself to do that without consulting with the players, it just wasn't handled the right way.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds reasonable. Everything sounds reasonable there, except for that rules official that kind of butted in when didn't need to be. I can understand Phil's aggravation with the situation as well, and it could have been handled differently if they had handled the tee times differently as well, and not tried to fit everything in the TV window. But that's 2 years ago. But I was just always curious as to what Phil's reaction was to that. I'm curious as well, what is the most ridiculous situation where you've ever had to tend the pin?
I tell you that one of the first times that Phil ever did it at the old International in Denver, I think it was the first time actually he ever asked me to tend the pin on a pitch shot. And we were playing with, I think, Faxon and Davis Love. And Phil was like short of these greenside bunkers and two on the 17th hole. And he asked me to go up there and tend it. And so, you know, Phil's kind of out of earshot. So as I'm going up to tend the flag, Faxon and Davis and their caddies are just giving it to me, you know. And, you know, what are you going to do if he chunks it in the bunker, you know, and all that stuff. And so that – and then, of course, Phil hold it, you know what I mean? So I remember that one specifically as being really fun. Actually, that was in 1993, I believe. And then, of course, the year that he did it at San Diego that kind of gets some airplay to this day. You know, he asked me to go tend the flag, and I wasn't surprised because he hits a lot of great pitch shots, and we all remember Charles Howell hitting that flag and going back in the water there several years before. So that kind of thought was in his mind too. So he tells me to go up there and tend the flag. So I'm running up there. It was like a 75, 80-yard shot, and I'm tending the flag, and it occurs to me, given the position of the sun, that if I lose this ball in the sun and it comes down and hits me in the head, it's going to be like the biggest blue sports blooper of all time. So I was over there choking my guts out about picking this ball up as it sailed through the clouds. And fortunately, I didn't. It all worked out. But we've had some fun with that over the years.
How much of it is practical and how much of it is a little bit of showmanship in Phil?
You know what? I'll tell you, it's at least 99% practical because okay. – If they had if they kept a stat on the tour, he and I talk about this all the time, for the number of times a pin is hit inside, you know, 125 yards in the air, I take my man every single year against anybody because he practices these shots incessantly at home. And he's really, really good at just kind of dialing up these yardages. So he hits a lot of flags. And, you know, 1 year at the Deutsche Bank on this 15th hole, he hit this certain front pin position. He hit this flag 2 years in a row from like 115 yards. And I remember he was just absolutely beside himself. So, you know, as we've seen over the years, I remember at Marion, Lee Westwood hitting one of those wicker baskets mm-hmm. on a wedge shot. And you know, the ball went somewhere crazy. And I think he made double. I think he was in contention at the time. So those guys are so darn good. That's something you have to think about at times.
The Phil U.S. Open narrative has been, you know, beaten over the head for many, many years, and it's not going to stop until he wins one, or forever, it won't ever stop. But looking at the courses going forward with the U.S. Opens to be held, is there a particular course you think he'd be the most excited for?
Let's see. So we've got Erin Hills next year, and I'd be lying. I don't know anything about Erin Hills. you know, other than it's in Wisconsin, and I hear there's not many places to stay.
the important thing's to you.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you tell me, going forward, where are the locations after that?
I'm pulling it up here to make sure I get it right, actually, because I'm not positive. I know 2019 is in Pebble. 2018 is Shinnecock. 2019 is Pebble. 2020 is Winged Foot. And then Torrey Pines, the country club, Los Angeles Country Club. Now we're getting up into 54-year-old Phil. So.
Well, certainly, you know, Shinnecock, I mean, he's, you know, one of the things that Phil's proved over the years that he has, you know, he feels like he has mojo at certain courses. He goes there and just has a great feel. Phil played, you know, people ask me all the time about, you know, which, you know, oh my gosh, you know, what went down at Wingfoot must have been incredibly hard in terms of accepting the loss the way it all played out. And I tell people all the time, you know, it's not nearly as hard as when you play great and don't win. And mm-hmm. Phil played great at Shinnecock in 04 and lost to Goosen. I'll never forget that day, you know, Phil lost. I think he might have made birdie on 14, 15, and 16. Then we made double on 17 and lost to Goosen by two. And I remember getting in my car as I left, and I had all these messages on my phone, and the first one was from Joe LaCava, who caddied for Fred at the time and now caddies for Tiger. And he left his message and said, you know, no matter what you do, don't ever watch a replay of the golf today. And that was just basically him saying, you know, on greens that ultimately died that day, and I think they were dead a year later, you know, it's tough, you know, when you're playing on hard, baked-out greens and, you know, guys making 30-footers on greens where it's hard to make a 5-footer, you know, and he just played incredibly well and it just didn't work out. So those, you know, that loss was much tougher than Wingfoot. But again, he I know he feels really good about Shinnecock. So, and what was the other one that you mentioned right before or after it?
Pebble is 19 and then Wingfoot is 20.
Yeah, well, he loves Pebble. I mean, he's won there 3 or 4 times. He had a chance to win there in 2010, so that's good mojo, too. So I look forward to both of those.
And if I remember right, Shinnecock in 04, that was the year that things really got out of control, right, where they were watering the greens in between groups. And I think the ninth green or one of the greens just got completely messed up, and there was guys putting it off the green. Am I remembering that right?
That's 100% right. We got on a par 3 on the front nine, I think. I think it might be about 7 or 8, and Phil and I were talking on the tee. And we were like, the only possible way we can make par on this hole is to intentionally miss the green in regulation. Hmm. So I remember he had an 8-iron, and the goal was to hit it in this one left bunker, and then you would possibly have this angle on a bunker shot that was uphill. And he hit this incredible 8-iron right in the middle of the bunker. It didn't bury, hit this incredible bunker shot to 3 or 4 feet, and I think made it for 3. And we picked up, you know, whatever, a shot on the field, because I think it was just a disaster. And it was that week when we were going in there to sign, or the guys were going in there to sign the cards, and they were having like the head USGA guy was in there apologizing to everybody for what had happened and, you know, the condition of the greens and all that stuff. It just completely got away from them.
What do you think, and what do you think Phil thinks about the way U.S. Open courses are treated now? I personally think there's been progress towards making things a little bit better, test graduated rough and certain things, but I think the players are recognizing it as the setups have been better. I mean, I'm sure there's still plenty of people that do not like the way the USGA sets up golf courses, but what do you think about the trend in the courses they're using, how they set them up, and how does Phil feel about it?
You know, I can't really speak for Phil, because, you know, obviously it's a fairly sensitive subject, sure, given what he does. But, you know, I think that it's certainly gotten better. But then again, I mean, when you have situations, you know, like last year at Oakmont and what went on with Dustin on that green and that ridiculous ruling, I mean, as you know from probably going there, you just can't have greens with that kind of pitch at that kind of speed. And I think that, you know, as long as that goes on, you're kind of asking for trouble. But then again, to your point, I mean, I remember in 2001 at the course in Tulsa, Southern Hills, that the 18th green at Southern Hills is absolutely huge. And if you stood in the middle of that green and dropped the ball from 3 or 4 feet above the ground, the ball would land on the green, roll off the green, and roll 60 yards down this hill. Ugh. And I remember at the time the guy setting up the golf tournament saying, well, that's okay, we just won't cut this green as low as the other 17. And the players were like, but this is the U.S. Open, you know what I mean? And that was the green ultimately on Sunday, where you had the short miss from Stewart Cink, I think, and Retief Goosen, you know, missing it from a foot and a half to win the tournament. It was just chaos on that green because, in my opinion, the USJ had got the setup completely wrong and guys were completely psyched out on that green. But it's definitely better. But, you know, I think it can get better still.
I was reading a little bit, or maybe I heard you on another podcast talk a bit about how you chart golf courses, and I found it very interesting. I think a quote I heard from you say is like, after playing hole 16 at Augusta over the years, you play that hole 8 yards shorter or something like that. How much of that of your like knowledge at this point in your career, 20 plus years in, can you rely on prior experience, and are your Tuesdays and Wednesdays a little easier charting courses than they were 10, 20 years ago?
Yeah. You go on these major courses are on these rotations, obviously, and you know every several years you go back and you have all these notes and all this, you know, knowledge from the previous tournament. So yeah, it definitely gets a little easier in terms of what you acquire. And you know, Phil's gotten to the point now where he's done so much coursework on these courses that, you know, we didn't, like, say at Muirfield in 2013, have to go there and, you know, in a sense, break the course down hole by hole. And, you know, the week ended up being, you know, easier in terms of, you know, prior to and a week that he ended up winning. But you're right. I mean, what I find, especially at Augusta that you referenced, is that you have these little theories about holes. And, yeah, you know, that was always our little secret. And I think then Phil mentioned it once in an interview about how if you go back and you watch the history of the Masters and guys playing 16, the number of times you see guys posing over shots on 16 and the ball coming down 25, 30 feet behind the hole, which is probably the hardest putt at Augusta National behind the hole on 16 on Sunday. So, you know, I don't know why it is. It's a very low spot on the golf course. There's 20,000 patrons, it seems, sitting around, and maybe there's just not much oxygen there. I don't know. But the ball just seems to just take off the club there, especially as compared to the other 17 holes. So it was kind of crazy. But in 2004, we had talked about this and never put it into play. And when Phil, you know, was chasing down Ernie in 2004, at least trying to, as he walked off of 15 green, he just made kind of a disappointing par. And Phil still needed to make a birdie to tie Ernie for the lead, who was close to finishing. We walked to the 16th tee there from 15 green, and we were like, okay, let's plug this thing in there. And we got there, and it was a flat-out 7-iron yardage. And he just decided, he hit 8, 15 feet underneath the hole and made 2, and, you know, that certainly helped.
No matter how many times you rewatch that 2004 Masters, it never gets old. I mean, it really is pretty storybook for when that first Masters. Was it 31 on the back 90 shot?
It was, yeah, yes, it was. Yeah, he birdied 5 of the last 7, I believe. Yeah, it was cool. Thanks.
Epic. So Augusta's very famous for making a lot of tinkering, a lot of changes to the golf course. I know Phil likes to go there at least once or twice, maybe before the Masters. I'm curious, do players get notified about what changes are made, or do you guys show up there and are you like, oh, well, this bunker's a little bit different, or this hill's changed? Is it kind of secretive, or do they inform the players when they make changes to the golf course?
From what I've seen, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I know that, if I'm not mistaken, I think they've told the guys at times that they redo like a couple of greens a year just to keep them fresh. Mm-hmm. And of course, they put them back together just, you know, exactly as they were. I mean, that place is amazing. I mean, it's such a great tournament, and it's so well run the way they do things. But there's no question that you will definitely notice things that aren't necessarily official, like, you know, the first tee just continually creeping back towards the putting green, or the, you know, I know you hear stories like, I think it was Charles Coody who used to talk about how when he first started playing the Masters, you would walk straight out of the pro shop door and there where the first tee would be. Well, now you'd have to turn left and go 100 yards left to get to it. So There's definitely been some. I remember one year left at the 13th green, there's that little shallowed out area left of 13, and it wasn't nearly as shallow as it had been previously, and I don't think that was kind of like officially kind of put out there. But you know what, that tournament, those guys, as far as I'm concerned, those guys can do whatever they want because they do it so well. They run such an amazing tournament, and it's just such a pleasure to be there.
That's what I was going to say, is it's amazing how much they do make changes, and there's never an issue. Like, there just never is. Just the issues you cited with the U.S. Open, obviously they don't have the same continuity in the golf course and don't know the courses as well when they make the changes, but it is amazing how they can just, you know, make a change year over year and people don't even notice it for the most part. But when you're at the Masters, when you're at Augusta, how much do you think, like, let's say it's a Sunday afternoon round, it's typically the same pin positions for the most part on Sunday. If he's got a putt, you know, like an 8-foot putt, 12-foot putt, are you ever thinking like, well, in 2010, I remember this, he missed this low. People say like you remember the break in the greens at Augusta more than you read them. Is that something you practically apply?
Yeah, and unfortunately for me, I work for a guy that's completely plugged into that, and I think that's part of the reason he's had success there, and a part of the reason why Tiger's had the success there that he's had, because they have these memories where they just get locked in and they absolutely remember it. And you know, referencing back to 04 Masters, Phil made this critical two on 12. And I do remember him telling me, you know, as we were walking to 13T, he was like, man, I've missed that putt low and I've missed that putt high. So I figured I absolutely knew what the break was this time. And he made it. And I think he might have made the same putt in 06 when he went on to win. So you're 100% right. And getting back to what you were talking about Augusta and the way those guys do things, a quick story about that is very early in Phil's career, we were playing the first round of the Masters, and we got to the second tee, and you know, and everything's put in the same spot, everything's right where it should be. And the guys that had put out the water fountains, or the water jug, if you will, where you get a little clump of water out there, had put it on the tee box, not thinking about guys being left-handed hitting off the tee. So you could literally, Phil could tee up his ball and take a swing and hit the water jug. And so two or three times that day, we had to move water jugs because they, you know, just it had slipped past this one guy. And the next day I was out walking pins, you know, at the golf course, and there's 40,000 people out there. Phil had an afternoon time and I'm in amongst these people, and I certainly don't have my caddy outfit on. And I'm walking up, you know, back to the clubhouse. I'm a half a mile away down there by, I don't know, 7 Green or something like that. And this man comes over to me, and he's like the water jug guy. He's the guy that put it out. And, you know, somehow they, you know, they know you're out there. You know what I mean? They, you know, it's amazing. They know everything that's going on at Augusta. And he came out and apologized to me. And it's just amazing how professional those guys are and how seriously they take their tournament.
That's the only defense the course has against the left-handed domination that's happened over the last few years. I've heard you give a couple examples in the past, or at least one example in the past, but I'm curious as to if you could think back to a situation where you felt maybe a regret you have, or felt like you did something along the way that cost Phil, that you look back at and said, man, I had that one wrong.
Yeah, definitely. 99 U.S. Open against Payne Stewart. You know, it was such an amazing day, you know, at that golf course, you know, such a great golf course. And then we started having this kind of really kind of awesome weather, and it started misting, you know what I mean? It was almost like they were playing in Scotland, and Payne made this incredible, like, 25, 30 footer for par on 16 to take a one shot lead. And then he stiffed it on 17 with the honor, hit it to 5 or 6 feet, and Phil hit it to 10 feet. And Phil asked me to read the putt, and you know, to this day, I regret the read that I gave him. I mean, I thought it was a straight putt, and you know, looking at it there at the time and on TV after the fact, the ball definitely broke right and missed right, and of course, Payne, you know, makes the putt on the last hole to beat Phil by one, you know, there's no question by 100 miles, if I could change one thing over the course of my caddy career, that, you know, in terms of input that I gave Phil, it would be that.
Yeah. All right. We won't dwell on the regrets any longer then. But,
no sweat.
What would you say in your whole career? What would you say you're most proud of?
I don't ever want to be like a pat myself on the back guy. So, you know, I don't know. I'm proud of the job I've done for Phil. That's probably, you know, the best way to do it. I mean, I think that, you know, you kind of judge yourself by, you know, what kind of job did you do for the guy when there was a lot on the line? You know what I mean? And you know, if you're, you know, in 56th place and, you know, you're hitting a 7-iron into the 18th green, you know, it's, you know, there's not a lot of heat on, you know, in terms of at that times. But, you know, I just hope that when Phil's done and he thinks back to those days where, you know, he won his majors and things were really important, that he's happy with the job I did in terms of the advice I gave him.
Have you ever seen Phil play any better than he did at the 2016 Open Championship?
I don't think I have. I mean, I'm still trying to process that whole week. You know, at the time when it was happening and when it ended, you know, I was very happy for Henrik and his caddy, Lordy, who's a tremendous guy too, and he deserved it. And he played he played unbelievable, obviously. But in the days that followed, you was just like, man, you know, how did Phil not win? And you kind of pick it apart and all that stuff. And it was just amazing golf. It was amazing the reaction that it got from people, and I was blown away by like the comments of Jack Nicklaus after the fact, suggesting that possibly it was as good or better than their duel in the Sun with Watson in 77. So it was really cool to be out there. I got to tell you a quick story about that. So those guys are playing, and it's just getting crazier and crazier, and just in terms of, you know, how big it is out there and the reactions of the crowds and all that stuff. I think Phil picks up a shot on 11 and then makes a 25, 30 footer for par on 12, which was just this huge momentum saver for us. And the place is just going bananas. And so we get to the 13th tee there and Henrik and Phil both drive off the tee, and everybody walks off the tee, and I'm the last guy off the tee, and I'm walking off, and this guy goes, excuse me, and it's the walking official with the RNA, and he says to me as we're walking off the tee, he goes, will you please run up there and let the guys know that they need to catch up with the group in front of them? And I thought to myself, are you kidding me right now? I mean, these guys are putting on the show of shows out there. The whole world's watching this, I think. And you want me to run up there and tell these guys that you've got a problem with what's going on out here? I said, no, I'm not going to. Or words to that effect. And we left the whole thing alone. But I just thought to myself, in the wake of the whole thing at the U.S. Open just a couple weeks before, I thought to myself, boy, these guys just can't leave well enough alone sometimes.
There's no one behind you either. It's not like you're holding up the course.
Right. Everybody's on the edge of their seats. I mean, it's like a rock concert out there at the golf tournament. I mean, I thought to myself, now, why would you intrude on this?
Yeah. I don't know if this makes you feel better or worse about it, but a friend of mine, Jake Nicklaus, who's a very incredible statistician, and I don't know the formulas they used to come up with this, but he said that Phil's performance at the Open Championship this year was the fifth greatest performance, basically in relation to the field, in major championship history.
Wow.
And Henrik Stenson's was second only to Tiger's 2000 U.S. Open.
Oh, no kidding. That's fascinating. That's very interesting. Yeah, it makes total sense. Well, that's cool.
If I'm able to get the article or how he came up with that, I'll send it over to you. But yeah, I don't know if that helps or hurts. I don't know how to ask a question about that either. I'm so curious as to how Phil views that tournament, knowing that he realistically couldn't have done any better and to still lose. I don't know how you come to grips with that or come to terms with that. Is he able to move on for something like that, or does it stick with him?
Well, the saving grace is that he'd won it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If Phil had never won the Open Championship and that had happened this year, I mean, I can't speak for Phil, but I'd be out on a ledge. You know what I mean? It would be a brutal thing to deal with because I was in denial. That's kind of why I got emotional in 2013 when he won, because I was in denial about how big and important that tournament is. And, you know, Phil hadn't had all that much success. And it's just such an amazing week. And I'm always... You know, we caddy on the greatest tour in the world over here on the PGA Tour. It's amazing, and I wouldn't change a thing about it. But there's, you know, the Open Championship, you know, is a pretty darn special event. And to go over there, is especially when it's in Scotland, and it's just amazing. And I'm so grateful that Phil had won it, because otherwise it would have made this year incredibly tough to deal with.
Yeah, it's remarkable considering the early lack of success in his career at the Open, how it's viewed by many as his best chance to win majors these days. So it's amazing how his transition into that. But a few more questions and I'll let you go. I'm taking up a lot of your time and it's much appreciated. But I'm just curious what your thoughts are on what's something that goes into caddying that most fans outside the ropes don't recognize or don't realize that you got to do every week, or something that's way harder than it looks.
Wow. I would say certainly, you know, any caddy worth their salt is going to be out there walking the course, you know, once or twice. So you're looking at the golf course before you see your player. Another thing that people might be surprised about is how much the weather plays into club selection. It's just crazy. These guys they hit the ball so hard and so flush that the sun going behind the clouds and the temperature going from 75 to 65 can significantly affect your club selection. Mm-hmm. 1 year at Tucson, Phil had to make par on the last hole at Tucson National. Very early in his career to win the tournament, you're trying to just stack up as many wins as you can. It was probably something like 94, 95. And he drove it in the fairway on the last hole, and there was a ruling up on the 18th green with the group in front of us. And he had something like, 203 yards, and you're in the desert, so the ball goes forever, and it's 75 degrees. And as this ruling was taking place, the sun went behind the mountains because it was late in the afternoon and the temperature dropped significantly. And I remember he hit 4-iron on the front edge of the green and 2-putted to win the tournament. So that kind of shows you how much with those guys, just the weather can affect things. So I would say that would probably be the thing that would surprise people the most.
Yeah, well, I didn't realize it was at that much depth. But what's what event out there treats the caddies the best?
Ah, great question. Let's see. Well, the Masters is up there. Charlotte's tremendous. And I don't want to leave anybody out, but, it's really gotten, quite good here of late in terms of parking and food and stuff like that. And guys are really aware. And I got to say that I think the guy that just took over, Jay Monahan, who's the new commissioner of the tour, things are only going to get better. He's, I don't know if you ever had a conversation with the guy, but he's an amazingly impressive guy. And I think everything on the tour is going to get better moving forward as Jay kind of runs the show.
Very good. 5 years ago, you told Golf.com you don't see Phil playing on the senior tour. I'm sure it's a question you get a lot. He's now 4 years away from being eligible. Has anything changed there?
I might hedge on that a little bit just because, Phil... Phil's very, very competitive, and that's certainly part of what makes him successful. And, I think that, he's going to want that competition. And listen, the way he's thinking and the way he's playing and the fact that he's, I think a lifetime member of the tour because he's got over 20 victories or something like that, or he's exempt for life, that he can continue to play as long as he wants to play. I think that, if there was a U.S. Senior Open at a really cool course, I might hedge a little bit and say I could possibly see him playing that event, but he's going to be playing somewhere.
So you think he's going to be pegging on the PGA Tour well into his 50s then?
I do. I definitely do. I think, his health, knock on wood, seems, for the most part, has been really good throughout his career. I just think that he wants to compete and he wants to compete against the best and he's going to be out there for a while.
All right, last one. This may be a tough one to end on, but if you were to think back to one moment, shot, conversation, anything that best defines the relationship between you and Phil, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
It would be the shot out of the trees on 13 at Augusta at the 2010 Masters. Just, that story has been told, a lot, and I don't know if you want to hear it or you don't, but, the thing about Phil is he's one of those guys that when he's out there on Sunday at a tournament that he's contending in, he can tell you verbatim every single name on the scoreboard, what hole they're on and how many under par there are. He's just going to basically memorize it. And that week was all about chasing. Cause even with he made 2 eagles on Saturday on 13 and 14 and then almost eagle 15 and to try and catch, I think at the time Westwood, and you're just trying to get out in front. Phil wants to lead, obviously. And, I think everybody does. And, we got there, he hit that ball into the trees up on 13 and, if you look at that shot on television, the trees, it looks like there's a decent gap in the two trees, but TV didn't do that shot justice in that the two trees he was going between were quite a ways apart. I think they were like 8 or 10 feet apart, which made the gap much smaller. I think it was about the width of a box of a dozen balls. And, and I got up there and I gave him the yardage. He had something like 204 yards, and I just felt sure he was going to tell me that he was going to go for it in two. So I asked, and he said, yeah, I'm definitely going here. You know, what club do you like? Yeah, and so I told him, you know, we were discussing five or six iron. I told him I thought, I liked hard six. He liked hard six also. And then as a caddy, you're kind of just taking your player's temperature. You know, is he 80% in? Is he 100% in? And so I was trying to think a little bit about how I could go back at him in terms of, you know, how is he really feeling here? And up in front of us, KJ Choi missed a six-footer. And as a result of missing that putt, it was the first time I think Phil led the whole week. I think actually he became tied for the lead there because we kind of heard a murmur in the crowd, and I asked one of the cameramen. And so I went back to Phil and I said, hey, man, I said, here's the deal. I don't change what you want to do, but you're now leading. You know, do you want to maybe pitch this out given, you know, the fact you're the best wedge player on the tour? You got a great chance of making four. And he said to me, listen, he said, at some point today, I'm going to have to hit a really great shot under a lot of pressure. I'm going to do it right now, which was A, what he was going to do, but it was also my signal to get the heck out of the way and let him hit this shot. And he did, and it was, you know, arguably the most famous shot he'll ever hit in his life. And it was awesome, but it to me, it kind of just encapsulates, you know, the kind of confidence that he plays with. You know, he plays aggressively. He's always, you know, said he would do that, and he's done that. It's been, you know, an incredibly, you know, fun 25 years for me watching this guy kind of ply his trade, and I was just kind of grateful to be there at that moment and throughout his whole career.
I can think of no better way to wrap up the No Laying Up podcast than with that story right there. So with that, I'm going to let you go, Bones. Thank you so much for spending an hour of your time. Best of luck with your rehab. Get the golf clubs out. Hopefully there's not too much dust on them. And I'd love to do this again sometime. This was an absolute blast.
No, I appreciate you having me on. Congratulations on all your success, and hope you have a great holidays.
Thanks, you too, Bones.
Okay, bye-bye.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!